This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, rising gas prices, rising insurance costs, and rising payroll taxes. Happy New Year, middle class. We'll talk with NPR's senior business editor Marilyn Giewex in just a few minutes about all the things that are squeezing the middle class right now, as if you hadn't noticed. But first, we want to talk again about efforts to keep Americans safe from gun violence. Earlier this week, President Obama was in Minnesota for a campaign-style event to push his gun safety plans, and he also talked about some of the work that the Senate is doing on the issue.
Democrats and Republicans in the Senate are working on a bill that would ban anyone from selling a gun to somebody legally prohibited from owning one. That's common sense. There's no reason why we can't get that done. That is not a liberal idea or a conservative idea. It's not a Democratic or Republican idea. That is a smart idea.
Now, the Senate is controlled by the Democrats, which is, of course, the president's party. But now this week came the first sign of bipartisan cooperation in the Republican-controlled House. On Monday, a bipartisan group of House members, two Republicans, two Democrats, introduced a bill of their own that would make it a federal crime to knowingly buy or transfer a firearm to someone who isn't supposed to have one. Joining us now to talk about this is one of the bill's sponsors. Congressman Elijah Cummings is a Democrat. He represents Maryland's 7th District that includes parts of the city of Baltimore. Congressman Cummings, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back to the program, and I would be remiss if I didn't say congratulations on the Ravens Super Bowl win.
Thank you very much, and Michelle, it's good to be with you.
Now, on a much more serious note, I think a lot of people are surprised to find out that it is not already a federal crime to knowingly transfer or buy a gun to somebody who's not supposed to have one, especially a convicted felon, or especially with the knowledge that that person intends to use it to commit a crime. Any idea why it isn't already a crime?
I don't know. That's a good question. It is a giant problem, a loophole, and it's one that anybody who wants to make sure that the laws are effective and efficient, and you know, we're in a position for those laws to do what they're supposed to do, seem like they would want the kind of legislation that we're talking about here.
As we mentioned, your district includes parts of the city of Baltimore, which certainly has a long experience with violent crime, including violent crime involving guns. How significant a part of that crime problem, in your view, is this phenomenon, as we said, of people transferring guns to people who aren't supposed to have them?
Oh, it's a major part. And a perfect example is a case that recently took place in Oakland, of course, an urban area. They discovered they were coming up, Michelle, with all these guns at crime scenes that were coming from a rural part of Georgia. Come to find out, there was a gentleman who was a convicted felon who had gotten his girlfriend to straw purchase guns for him, 64 of them in the course of about 2.5 months. They then sent those guns from rural Georgia to Oakland, and they were being sold and distributed by gang members there. So, you know, you take 64 guns and you place them in a city, and the police then begin to find those guns at crime scenes. And those kinds of things are happening all over the country. What we're trying to do is say to that person, say, for example, in this instance, the girlfriend, that instead of perhaps a slap on the wrist and getting probation, if she were to do that, based on local laws, we want a federal law saying that she would get 20 years. And we're also beefing up the straw purchaser law, saying that people would also be subject to a 20-year penalty if they were to purchase a gun for a known felon.
Do you have any concern at all, though? This is something that has been articulated a lot in connection with the so-called war on drugs, or in efforts to address the problem of illegal drugs, that a lot of people feel, and kind of the burden of law enforcement has really fallen upon the small fish and not the big fish, that a lot of the laws that are intended to catch the big fish really don't have that effect, that they actually wind up falling heaviest and having the heaviest impact on people who are not the so-called traffickers. And do you have any concern that that could be the same thing here?
Yeah, of course, I'm very sensitive to that, Michelle, having lived in the inner city of Baltimore for the past 32 years. But I think this is a little different. I mean, we're talking about somebody who literally goes out and tries to violate the law by purchasing a gun for somebody who's already a convicted felon. I don't think that there will be just members of minority communities who will be subject to this. In other words, I think you'll see a wide diversity of people who will come, sadly, under this law and be subjected to this penalty of 20 years. And you know, the other thing we got to do, keep in mind, is guns. You know, people use guns to kill. As you probably well know, my nephew was slain a year and a half ago. And, Michelle, I got to tell you.
We talked about it. Yes, I do remember.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry again.
And there's nothing like seeing your blood splattered on a wall and seeing brain matter on that wall. And that person was just a 20-year-old, wonderful kid, honor student at a university. And so when Sandy Hook came up, it just, you know, brought all that back up for me. And a lot of people are saying, well, Cummings, oh, this is just a limited law. You ought to be doing more. And perhaps we should be doing more. But this is something that we've gotten Republicans and Democrats to agree on. And this is some fresh news just for you, Michelle. A lot of people don't know this yet. But we're announcing today three more Republican sponsors to our legislation, and that's very significant. Michael Grimm of New York, Michael Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, and Peter King of New York. And this may very well, Michelle, be a breakthrough with regard to some of the other gun legislation. And by the way, this is something that police and prosecutors are begging for. They're not asking for this law. They're begging for it because they want to be more effective in their jobs.
Well, to that end, though, Congressman, the story of your nephew is a story that's been repeated all over this country for too long, as we've discussed. And people in law enforcement have been asking for quite some time for these kinds of measures. Why do you think it is that you and your colleagues on the other side of the aisle have had such a difficult time understanding each other on this issue or getting to common ground on this issue?
You know, I think that the National Rifle Association has spent so much time putting it out in the airwaves, on the airwaves, that folks are trying to take away the guns of sportsmen and collectors and people who simply want to protect their homes and hunters. And they seem to be putting that word out and saying that, you know, anything that has to do with guns and any kind of restrictions, any kind of laws, is going to take away their Second Amendment rights. And nothing could be further from the truth, particularly with regard to this piece of legislation. And I think just people having a fear, and we hear these arguments all the time, Michelle, that people think that at some point maybe government may not be doing all it needs to be doing, and they may have to protect themselves because government may fail to protect them. And we hear those things. And so at some point, though, there has to be a breakthrough. And Sandy Hook, I think, really caused a lot of people to look at some of these arguments. And going back to your question, looking at and then begin to look at each other and say, you know, whether you were a Republican, a member of NRA, or a Democrat, saying, wait a minute, hold it. These are our children. You've got, you know, 20 children shot, some of them as many 11, 12 times at close range, and you can't even identify the bodies, looking at their faces, some of them. Wait a minute, where are we going? And so I think maybe, you know, I often say that, and when my nephew died, I said the same thing. I said, death is a part of life, but sometimes life is a part of death. And what I mean by that is that sometimes it causes us to think and change our ways. And I think this is a critical moment, Michelle, where that dialogue finally may come to a point where both groups begin to listen to each other. And that's why this legislation is so significant, in that we sat down with some of our Republican colleagues and we listened to each other. And you know what, Michelle? We did not concentrate on what we disagreed on. We concentrated on what we agree on. And we said, okay, you know, we'd love for you to do some other things, but let's try to make something happen. Because the thing that we feared most, Michelle, was that we would concentrate on what we disagreed on and we would end up doing nothing.
Congressman, before we let you go, I did want to ask you one more question about an issue that's on a lot of people's minds today. President Obama has proposed another short-term solution to try to avoid these across-the-board spending cuts that will come to pass if there is not an agreement on deficit reduction. And he seems to be meeting a lot of resistance from House Republicans on this issue again, and also Republicans in the Senate, Republicans in general, let's just say. So where does the debate go from here? Do you see any opportunity for common ground on this issue?
I think that we at some point will move to some type of common ground, because I think the Republicans don't want to see our economy shrink. And we've already seen some indication of that from the GDP of the last quarter. So we've got to, I think the public will dictate, Michelle, a lot of what happens from here. I think the president is going out there and laying out the case, laying out a possible solution to the problem. But I tell you, when we start losing jobs at a pretty good clip, I think people are, and when people feel that situation is threatened, and businesses, by the way, they don't want to see this sequester go through. I think businesses and the public will put enough pressure on the Republicans to at least have them sit down and come up with some kind of a temporary solution to the problem so that we avoid sequester.
Congressman Elijah Cummings is a Democrat who represents Maryland's 7th District in the U.S. House of Representatives. And just by way of information, I do want to mention that we did reach out to your Republican co-sponsors on this bill, and their schedules simply did not permit them to join us today. And he was kind enough, Congressman Cummings was kind enough to join us from the studios on Capitol Hill. Congressman Cummings, thank you so much for speaking with us.
And thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up now, we're not trying to cause any friction here, but if you haven't already bought something sparkly for your beloved for Valentine's Day, you might want to hold off. We'll tell you why in just a few minutes. But first, speaking of buying stuff, if you are a person who receives a paycheck, you've probably noticed by now that your take-home pay is getting a little smaller since the beginning of the year, all things being equal, and some of your basic expenses like gas are costing more. So no, you are not imagining this. NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax is back with us. So tell us what's going on. Thanks for being here with us once again.
Hi, Michelle.
So the first thing we wanted to talk about is something that you'd actually warned us about at the end of last year, which is that that payroll taxes were going to go up at the beginning of the year. Tell us why.
We all pay into this Social Security system with something that we refer to as the payroll tax. So if you're a worker, you've got an employer, you're on somebody's payroll, 6.2% of your pay goes into this fund. And that's a good thing when you're 60. You want to look forward to getting that monthly check. But right now, it does take a bite out of your paycheck. Well, one of the things that Congress did 2 years ago to help the economy was to reduce that tax by 2 percentage points. That is, during the years of 2011 and 2012, you actually had more money to take home. So that was good for the economy. The average family got about $1,000 a year from that. But like all holidays, they come to an end, and that tax holiday expired as of January 1st. So now, all of a sudden, your paycheck is smaller.
So now it's going back up to the level that it was before, but it still feels kind of like an ouch.
Right.
But you're saying it's not just payroll taxes. Also, a lot of people are paying more for their health care costs. Tell us about that.
Well, we don't have solid data on exactly what it's costing people yet, but we know from health insurance companies have been going to their regulators asking for these hikes. Anecdotally, you hear a lot about people seeing more coming out of their paychecks, higher copays. The prices have been going up. So if you're a typical worker, all of a sudden your take-home pay is smaller because of the higher premiums, smaller because of the higher payroll tax. And, you know, you're kind of scratching your head. Where did my money go?
And speaking of scratching it, when you think about, you know, you get in the car to go cash that paycheck, people who still do that, or go to the grocery store, let's say, and you see that gas prices are creeping up, even though it's the beginning of the year. And I think that a lot of people are used to the idea that gas prices kind of inch up over the course of the year. You can maybe tell us why that is, but why now?
Well, it is a bit of a shocker. Again, you all of a sudden you open up that first paycheck in January and you see you have less money, and then you're paying more and a lot more for gasoline. In just the past week, it's gone up about 18 cents a gallon. That's very shocking for this time of year. We're now up to about $3.54 a gallon on average for regular unleaded gas. And of course, if you live in California, it's much worse than that. It's more than $4 a gallon. So this is really a big bite out of people's paychecks. The reasons for that, there are kind of a lot of little reasons, everything from Superstorm Sandy disrupted gasoline supplies on the East Coast. You've had some refinery fires that have happened. There's also normal maintenance that's been going on some of the refineries. But usually these kinds of problems don't all come together so much in winter. And another part of the equation there is that crude oil prices have been high. There's a lot of tension in the Middle East. And the rest of the world, the economy's perking up more in Asia, in Europe as well. So there's an expectation that there will be more demand for oil in the coming year from around the globe. So you put it all together, and all you know is that when you drive up to the pump, it's expensive.
Well, speaking of this, and if you're just joining us, I'm speaking with NPR's Marilyn Gwex. We're talking about the middle class squeeze a lot of people are feeling right now. We're here to tell you, you're not imagining it, that, you know, if you have a middle class paycheck, chances are you're feeling the pinch in a number of areas. To the point that you were making, Marilyn, we caught up with the owner of a gas station. His name is Mahmoud Qasim. He's better known as Mike to his customers in Struthers, Ohio. He says he can actually lose money selling gas because of tight margins and credit card costs, and that the high gas prices are actually bad for his business. And you might think it's the other way. You think, you know, he's great, mm-hmm. but he says, no, here it is.
Instead of buying a case of beer, they'll buy six-pack. Instead of buying a carton of cigarettes, they'll buy one pack. Yeah, instead of buying like a cup of coffee, probably they might, because, you know, I'll make coffee at home. When the gas prices goes up, our sale on the inside goes down automatically because people have less money to spend.
You also talked to him. Tell us a little bit more about him, if you would.
He is a Palestinian who was raised in a refugee camp in Lebanon, but he moved to this country because he was hoping for the land of opportunity. He lives in Northeast Ohio, and he told me that he feels like in the years that he's been in the United States, he's seen the income gap widen. He feels like a lot of his customers say that the rich are doing pretty well, but it's not so great for regular people.
Did anybody talk about at least one of these factors, that the payroll tax cut is a matter of policy? Now, obviously, there's a lot of debate over the whole health care question, which we're not going to revisit. But the payroll tax cut was an explicit decision that policymakers could have. And they could have made a different choice and not let the tax holiday expire. Mm-hmm. Could they have set the rate lower permanently? They chose not to. And I just wondered, was there any thought about this kind of January shock to the system?
Well, a lot of economists did warn about this. And I think economists were a little surprised, a little shocked themselves that Congress went with this very sudden increase in the payroll tax. When I was talking to economists last fall, everyone was saying, you know, they really need to phase this back in to not shock people so much, make a change, over 6 months or over a year or two and get people accustomed to this idea. Well, Congress chose not to do that. Now, the politics of that, keep in mind, the payroll tax funds Social Security, and Democrats, you know, support Social Security very vigorously. So they didn't want people to get used to that lower payroll tax. They wanted to get back to full funding. And, of course, Republicans were very concerned about debt and deficit issues. So they were all sort of agreed that that they just take us right over this cliff of sorts, and suddenly your paycheck is smaller.
To that end, though, there is another issue on the table right now in front of policymakers, and that's this question of these across-the-board spending cuts that could take effect fairly soon if Congress and the White House don't agree on a deficit reduction package. We're calling this the sequester. Mm-hmm. You know, the funds would actually be sequestered or taken off the table. We mm-hmm. talked earlier with Congressman Elijah Cummings, and he said that really the government needs to avoid this at all costs. Would there be an impact on middle-class families if this were to take place, beyond the people who we know are directly affected, like people who are contractors, for example, right, people who are federal employees?
Well, Michelle, let me just say that all the things we've talked about so far, the reduced take-home pay, the higher gasoline, it's really eroding consumer confidence. And a big part of the economy is consumer spending. People need to be confident to spend money. And one of the key factors, I mean the key factor in your sense of confidence, is knowing that you have a job, that you will, even if your paycheck's a little smaller, you want to know you have a paycheck. Well, with this big across-the-board spending cuts coming for people who say you work in a machine shop and you do work for defense contractors, or you work directly for companies that do business with the government in all sorts of ways, if you don't know if you're going to get cut in March, People say that it could be 800,000 jobs lost if this goes forward. So you're putting together an awful lot of pressure on consumer confidence. People are worried about their jobs. They're worried about their paychecks. They're worried about what they have to spend. And when you look at the consumer confidence data, last fall, people were rising. They were feeling better. There was a certain surge in confidence up until about October. And then now it's really dropping rapidly. And that is not a good economic sign.
Well, Marilyn, can you leave us with some hope? Is there any
yes.
is there any relief on the way at all? Are there any bright spots out there?
No, there's always another hand when you're talking about economics. So on the other hand, there are some good things, and we've talked about this too in the past, Michelle, that housing is looking good, the energy sector is strong, auto manufacturing is pretty good just because things wear out. And let's say you were a truck manufacturer, you're looking at the energy sector is doing well, agriculture is doing well, home construction is doing well. That means people are going to buy trucks this year. So there are people who are tied to the automotive industry who have reasons for optimism. And really, more than anything, some of that surge in housing really could spread out jobs and maybe will turn this corner. But right now, it's dicey.
Marilyn Gee, who acts as a senior business editor here at NPR. She was with us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Michelle.
And switching gears now, you know Valentine's Day is just around the corner, and maybe you're eyeing some nice chocolates or perhaps comparison shopping for roses or even something sparkly for your special someone. Well, our next guest, journalist and author Mark DiVincenzo, says, hold on for a minute. You might remember that we spoke to him last month. He told us that there are bad times, good times, and better times to do and buy just about everything. He's a contributor to Time Magazine's Smart Spending column and most recently the author of Buy Shoes on Wednesday and Tweet at 4. So we thought this would be a good time to have him back to ask him, what should you buy this month, especially for your Valentine? So, Mark, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us once again.
Great to be back, Michelle.
So, you know, of course, Valentine's Day coming up next week, and I assume most people are thinking about chocolates, roses, perfume, and jewelry, but you say don't. Why?
Well, I hope you've bought those things by now. Because February is not a great time to buy those things. And it's because the retailers know you want them, and they're not going to discount them for you. It's like jewelry is especially bad to buy this time of year, especially in early February. They have these false sales where they drive up the price, and then they put it on sale. So the consumer's not making out there at all. The good news is, if there's a good place to buy any of this stuff, I don't mean this to be a commercial, but the warehouse stores probably have the best prices on things like boxes of chocolate and jewelry.
So if you didn't follow your advice from January and saying, you know,
right,
buy early, you can still find some deals. But generally what you say is February is one of the six gift-giving months, May, June, October, November, and December, Christmas, where you're going to expect to pay top dollar, so don't do that. So what is February a good month to do or buy?
Well, February is a good month to buy a lot of things. For one, cell phones. In the last couple of years, you could find buy one, get one free deals, one for you, one for your sweetheart. Also, cameras. The manufacturer sort of trade shows, they happen this time of year. They're introducing new models, and the retailers need to make room for these new models. So the older models, which are perfectly good, they go on sale, and sometimes up to about 40% off. If you can wait, the President's Day weekend is the best weekend.
To buy a camera so you can take a picture of your special person.
Yeah,
and if you're really into nesting, I think you were telling us, there's another big ticket item that's a good thing to buy this time of year.
Yeah, furniture. New models are arriving this month. And so starting in January and then into February, you could find up to 40% off, especially living room and dining room furniture. These stores have to make room for the new stuff, so they want to sell the older stuff.
I think that might scare somebody on a first date, though, if you took them shopping for a dining room set. I don't know if I recommend them. I'm just saying, I would appreciate that, but I don't know that I want to recommend people. And they would be answering letters from the people saying, why did he take me shopping for a dining room set? That's not what I'm saying. Anyway, so even though Valentine's Day is a time for love and romance, you say, what if you want to do something for yourself? What is February a good month to do for yourself?
Well, it's a good time to get checked out by your dermatologist. Your skin is at its most fair this time of year, so it's easier for them to see moles and blotches and things that could become cancerous.
Okay, now, some of us are not as you said, fair, normally, is this still, if you are of a different skin tone, is this still a good time to visit a dermatologist?
You know, dermatologists will tell you that you should get checked out once a year. And as you know, as most people know, even if you are of an ethnicity that has darker skin, it's still going to be a bit lighter in the winter.
I'm trying to think of a joke, but I won't. But so finally, Valentine's Day isn't just about presents. It can also be about that romantic date night or weekend. Is there some place that is a particularly good deal at this time of year?
Las Vegas is a great place to go in February in the winter when a lot of people stay away. So it's cheaper to fly there in February. It's cheaper to stay there in February.
Really? Anything else? What if you don't like Vegas?
Yeah, New York City, you know, it's always crazy. But in February, it's sort of a slow time for tourism, relatively speaking. So it's a lot easier to get tickets to Broadway shows. It's easier to get them at the TKTS booth in Times Square. You can get coupon codes on the internet. A lot of box offices will accept these coupon codes this time of year when it's slower. So you actually can save money by doing a Broadway show in February.
And if you have already done your due diligence and you know that this is the right person, you're saying that New York is also a good place to get married in February or to propose.
Yeah, the Empire State Building is a very, very famous place to propose. No one knows exactly how many people, but it's probably in the thousands. And it's also a place where a lot of people want to get married. It only happens once a year. Valentine's Day is the only day of the year where you could get married at the top of the Empire State Building. But there's a catch. You have to enter a lottery, you have to apply, and then you have to get chosen.
Well, that's not fun. But in terms of that, but you're saying you don't have to enter a lottery to propose it. You can propose there at any time. Is that right?
Right. Yes. And it's a very famous place to propose. And Valentine's Day is obviously the best day of the year to do that.
And yes, I think it is. Well, good. Hopefully that'll offer people some good luck. So, Mark, you know I'm going to ask you, what are you doing for Valentine's Day?
Well,
let's
my
make
wife
sure your
gonna...
other half is not listening.
Well, she is going to listen to this interview, so I'm going to
turn the dial down now. Turn the dial. No, turn the dial down. Mark, what are you doing? We're putting you on the spot. Come on. Are you buying furniture?
No, not buying furniture. I'm going to a special restaurant in town.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, I won't put you on the spot and ask you which one it is and whether you're getting a good deal there, because that's too much pressure. Mark DiVincenzo is a contributor to Time Magazine. He's the author of Buy Shoes on Wednesday and Tweet at 4. And he joined us from member station WHRO in Norfolk, Virginia. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Later in the program, I'm happy I have a chance to tell you more about two women who made or are making an impression, one by speaking up, one by choosing not to. That's coming up later in the program. But first, it's time for The Beauty Shop. That's where we get a fresh cut on the week's top issues with our panel of women writers, journalists, and commentators. Sitting in the chairs for a new do this week are Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief of the website The Wise Latina Club. Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian commentary and news website. Also with us is Danielle Belton. She's editor-at-large of Clutch Magazine Online. Welcome back, ladies. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Michelle.
Now, we want to go back to the subject we started with today, and that's the whole debate over guns and gun safety. Now, earlier in the program, you remember that we heard from one of the co-sponsors of a bill that, unusually for these times, apparently attracted bipartisan support. It would increase penalties when someone buys a gun or transfers one to someone who isn't supposed to have one. But I want to talk about the role that women are playing in this debate on both sides. Now, one person I want to point out, it has been a guest on this program. She's an attorney. Her name is Gail Trotter. She's with the conservative group, the Independent Women's Forum, and she testified on Capitol Hill last week against tighter gun restrictions. Here she is.
Guns make women safer. The Supreme Court has recognized that lawful self-defense is a central component of the Second Amendment's guarantee of the right to keep and bear arms. For women, the ability to arm ourselves for our protection is even more consequential than for men.
So I want to start out by asking each of you, do you think that that's true? Viviana, do you think that this issue is more consequential for women than for men?
I really don't, actually. And unlike many people who are advocates of gun rights, I've been a victim of a violent crime. Now, I am no Gabby Giffords, but when I first moved to Washington, D.C. 6 years ago, 1 week after I moved in front of my house, the very same day that my elderly parents showed up, we were mugged at gunpoint. My mother was separated from us. She was taken a few house lengths away from us. My dad and I were turned face down, and we had guns pointed to our head. That night, God walked with us because we only had our stuff stolen and the bejesus scared out of us.
That's terrifying. I'm so sorry that happened.
But I don't think that said that had I had a gun that night, I would be safer, or it would have made me safer, or things could have been different. And that's because of variables. I had my parents with me. They're elderly. My father, because of illness, is slow to move. What are the chances that I would have been able to corral them, to have nerves of steel, and to shoot at the perpetrators and not my parents?
Bridget, what about you?
Well, I mean, I come at this from the perspective not just as a woman, but, you know, I was born in Inglewood, California. So you kind of are come up with a given that, you know, you got to have a certain degree of street knowledge to keep yourself safe in this world. Now, I then ended up going into college and became a criminology major. And that is where I actually learned to shoot. I learned to shoot on an AR-15, which Gail Trotter was saying was a very easy gun for a woman to shoot. And it is. You know, I also learned on a 12 gauge, has a recoil, kicks you back. You know, 9mm Glock. I have small hands. You know, your hands don't always fit well around the butt of a gun. You know, but I think Viviana makes a good point in that, yes, there are situations where a gun wouldn't have been the best option for self-defense. You know, I also believe women should take self-defense courses, you know, et cetera. But I think that it is a feminist thing to be able to confidently stand your ground in the face of any threat and not count on others to protect you. And if that means that it is a gun in your hands that will do it at that point and in that situation, then yes, I believe in that. I don't believe, however, in the argument that it's more a woman's issue than a man's issue. I think it's equal.
Danielle, what about you?
I see self-defense as obviously an issue that both genders have to deal with and face. I don't necessarily think that the gun debate is different for women than it is for men, because we are just talking about basic self-defense, home defense here. Me personally, I don't own a gun, and there's been times in the past that I've considered it, but in most instances, I'm glad that I didn't, but that has to do with my own personal issues surrounding it. And so I feel like we have this tendency to give, like, these kind of catch-all, kind of like generic solutions where it's like, oh, this woman wouldn't be a victim if she had a gun. Oh, this guy would have been able to protect these people if he'd had one. But it's like a gun isn't a catch-all, one-stop solution to all of your problems. That's, you know, that's ludicrous. These issues have complexities to them. They're all their own individual issues. In some instances, maybe a gun would help. In others, it might not. And I feel like in my case, it definitely wouldn't have helped me. I was in a abusive relationship, and I considered getting a gun after the relationship ended, but then later on I got diagnosed with severe depression and then bipolar disorder, and I'm extremely happy that I did not own a gun during that time period, because I was not thinking clearly about my own personal safety at that point, and I shudder to think what would have happened to me if I'd had a gun during the worst point of my illness.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the role of women in the debate over gun violence, and our guests are a very honest group of participants today. That's Danielle Belton of Clutch Magazine Online. That's who was speaking just now. Bridget Johnson of PJ Media. That's a conservative libertarian online news website. And Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief at the website The Wise Latina Club. You know, I have to tell you from my standpoint, and I know I tend to go to the numbers because I kind of want to look at the big picture. But I see, you know, Gabby Gifford, the congresswoman from Arizona, who was, you know, so terribly wounded in this shooting incident at a political event in her district. And then you see somebody like Gail Trotter, and you see a lot of women sort of taking leadership on this, which I certainly appreciate. But, you know, men are 82 0.6% of murder victims who are killed by guns. African Americans are 6 times more likely to be murdered. And the murders of white women declined across all age groups from 1980 to 2008. And so I just have to ask, you know, and a number of commentators, I have to say, on a lot of the online sites and sites are saying, okay, why is it that the murders of, in some cities like in Chicago, where, you know, you had 500 people killed last year, why aren't we all crying over that? Why is it that these faces aren't the faces that come to our mind? And I don't know. I don't have an answer. Bridget, do you?
Well, I wouldn't say that the people who are out there right now promoting Second Amendment rights are not thinking about the murder victims in these cities. I think, though, that there is obviously a concentration on, you know, like any lobbyist group here in Washington. You know, what is the point that is going to drive it home with legislators? You know, what is the point that is going to drive it home with public opinion? And I actually think that right now, if trying to run with the women needed for protection argument is actually a mixed bag for conservative groups that are pushing it, because in the same group you have, you know, men who are putting women with weapons calendars up on their wall, thinking that it's a sexy thing for a woman to be armed, but then not supporting women in combat who are armed to protect this country. So,
Interesting point.
So there are mixed messages all the way around, and I think, yes, it brings in, you know, are we addressing the inner city murders?
Danielle, what do you think?
Well, I definitely feel like the reason why you have people who will get upset when an unusual murder takes place with a gun, or like a high-profile case that gets a lot of attention because it's not considered typical. Like you pointed out in your statistics, that often the main victims of gun violence tends to visit our communities, African American communities, and Black men a lot more frequently. And it's a sad fact of reality that if something has the appearance of being typical, even if it's something that is horrible, no one's shocked by it. No one gets upset about it. Like I get upset, and you might get upset, and the people in these neighborhoods and the families who love these individuals who've been victimized would get upset. But the public at large, they expect people in the inner city to die. Like, they're not shocked by it. And the solution is no easy solution. So rather than actually deal with it and try to find a viable solution, it's much easier for folks to just go, well, I just don't want to deal with this anymore because I see this problem year after year. So I'd rather just act like it doesn't exist. So people tend to get really wrapped up in an unusual shooting like Sandy Hook because it's like, oh, well, that could have happened to me. When people see a young Black male who's been gunned down and they say that it's gang violence, they go, well, that's not me, so I don't care. And that happens all the time, so I don't care.
Which is unfortunate because there's very, because I guess having done a lot of reporting in this area, you know, and I'll just say, having experienced this in my own family, that it's, you know, you add the sort of the stigma to the shock and the grief, is that not only is it that, you know, you've got the shock and the grief, but then you want to have people make it your fault. And, you know, sometimes you are a willing participant, but sometimes you just happen to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. And to sort of have that burden of having to say, well, actually, I didn't deserve, this person I love did not deserve to die, is really actually very profound. And I can't even describe it.
Well, this is the case with the young girl who performed at the inauguration, and who was from Chicago, who was just in a park with her friends and was murdered.
Viviana?
I was just going to jump in and say, and yet it's really important to think about the politics behind, for example, putting women on both sides of this debate. I think it's actually smart politics and smart rhetoric. A lot of people are looking at the polling data from election 2012 and are seeing the rise of new voters, including Latino voters, including single women voters. The only thing is this. So what we're seeing is there's an emphasis on protection, which Bridget was talking about, has pros and cons, as opposed to the right to bear arms. It's more emotional. We've seen this as well with the debate around reproductive rights. It's about compassion and support, would say one group. And the same thing with immigration. It's about family unification. These are emotional arguments. The thing is, as Bridget brings up, it could backfire.
Bridget, final thought. Is there something we're overlooking here? As a person who's studied, you know, you have both an academic and a personal interest in this, and you've also taken steps to make yourself competent around this issue, as opposed to sort of just as an intellectual sort of matter. Is there something you think people are overlooking?
I think that the propensity of the black market to bloom is being overlooked in this. Because so when I was a criminology major, the fellow students, shall we say, had a lot of personal weapons that at the time were not allowed under the assault weapons ban. And, of course, it's very easy to modify a semi-auto.
I'm going
to
check your purse before you leave, by the way. I'm just letting you know.
We used to say there was a fine line between criminal and criminologist. But that goes to knowing exactly what the criminal community is going to do to get around the new laws that are in place. And it's not going to be that hard with what's being proposed.
Bridget Johnson is the Washington, D.C. editor for PJ Media. She was here with us in our Washington, D.C. studios, along with Viviana Hurtado, blogger-in-chief at the Wise Latina Club. And Danielle Belton is the editor-at-large for Clutch Magazine Online. She joined us from St. Louis. Ladies, thank you so much once again.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
Finally today, I want to talk about, and I want you to hear, the voices of two women. One who is really at the beginning of her life, one whose life has just come to its end. One I had the privilege to meet, one I have not, at least not yet. But they are both women who stand for something. And here is the first.
Today you can see that I'm alive.
That is the voice of Malala Yousafzai. She is the Pakistani teenager who was targeted by Islamic extremists, literally targeted on the van she was taking home from school, just because she insisted on going to school and talking openly about it. You might remember that when she was shot in the head last October, it wasn't at all clear that she would survive, even after she was evacuated to England for treatment. But she did, and she literally has lived to tell about it. She spoke out in a new video put forward by the Malala Fund, a group helping to raise money to support the education of other Pakistani girls. Here's more.
I can speak. I can see you. I can see everyone. And I'm getting better day by day. It's just because of the prayers of people. Because all the people, men, women, children, all of them have prayed for me. And because of these prayers, God has given me this new life. And this is the second life. This is the new life. And I want to serve. I want to serve the people. And I want every girl, every child to be educated.
Now let me turn to the other woman I want you to hear from. She died on Monday at the age of 87. Her name was Essie Mae Washington Williams, and she was the biracial daughter of Strom Thurmond, the late longtime U.S. Senator from South Carolina. He ran for president in 1948 on a platform demanding separation of the races, although his views on racial separation evidently did not extend to fathering a child with his family's African-American teenage maid. The late senator never publicly acknowledged his biracial daughter, although he did offer her financial and emotional support at key points in her life. And in turn, Mrs. Washington Williams chose not to publicly expose Senator Thurmond as her father until after his death in 2003. When she finally did decide to speak out, this is what she said.
It was only at the urging of my children and Senator Thurmond's passing that I decided that my children deserve the right to know from whom, where, and what they have come. At this juncture in my life, I am looking for closure. I am not bitter. I am not angry. In fact, there's a great sense of peace that has come over me in the past year.
It occurred to me that young Malala is known for what she chose to say, and Mrs. Washington Williams for what she chose not to. And in the world you and I live in, young Malala is brave. Mrs. Washington Williams was not. But it also occurred to me that both are to be admired because what they wanted, really all they wanted, each in her own way, was the right to make a choice, to choose to speak or to keep silent. I think it's worth being reminded at a time when so many of us are so careless about what we say and the impact our words have, just how high a price some of us still pay for the simple privilege of speaking our minds or choosing not to.
Once I decided that I would no longer harbor such a great secret that many others knew, I feel as though a tremendous weight has been lifted. I am Essie Mae Washington Williams, and at last, I feel completely free.
May Essie Mae Washington Williams rest in peace, and may Malala Yousafzai live many years to tell us more. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.